Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Thursday evening Dhamma class from Cross River Meditation Center on September 6, 2018. This is the first Thursday of the month, and so our class is an introduction to meditation and mindfulness as the Buddha teaches meditation and mindfulness. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace. I know you've heard this before, but it really can't give a proper introduction to meditation and mindfulness as the Buddha teaches it without giving a little bit of his history and why he taught what he taught. Because in order to understand the Buddhist Dhamma, you have to understand it in context. He taught something that is very specific, and when the context is lost, the specificity of what he taught is lost as well. So he was born to a human mother and a human father. The reason why I say that is a lot of mythology about the Buddha's birth, almost relating it to Immaculate Conception, the Christian fable, and many of the other religious fables about their particular savior, that somehow it was an extraordinary birth. It was a completely ordinary birth. He was born to a king of a minor kingdom, but still had great power in northern India. His mom died shortly after giving birth, and he was raised by his aunt. Another common occurrence, and she was really, in those days, a king had multiple wives, and she became one of his wives. Even as a young kid, he was dissatisfied with his life, and he couldn't really understand it. And I relate directly to that. I was brought up in Berkeley Heights, a middle-class part of America, Berkeley Heights, New Jersey. I had great parents, and I had okay siblings. but I had everything any kid needed and most of the things that I wanted, and I was dissatisfied from the moment I was born. And I never understood why. And the Buddha had the same kind of, Siddhartha then was his name. He had much the same experience, and his father lavished him with everything he could possibly give him, hoping to impress him on him how wonderful it was to have this lavish lifestyle, hoping that Siddhartha would one day take over the king's throne. Because he was concerned that this young boy was so brilliant, and he was told, and there's a myth about that he was told by some three wise men, you know where that's coming from, that he would either be a great ruler or he would leave and seek spiritual understanding. And the king was hoping to prevent that by lavishing him with all this stuff, anything the kid could want, and more. Around the age of 5 years old, there's a little short story the Buddha tells, that he was having a particularly difficult day. For no reason except he was just frustrated with his life, and he didn't understand why he was so unhappy. And he sat down out of this frustration and said, "I'm just going to sit here and just try to calm myself down." And he started he realized his breath, and he started focusing on his breath, and he calmed down a little bit. The significance of that is that he would remember that 28 years later, and use that same meditation method. Anyway, at the age of 29, he snuck away from the kingdom. His father would not let him out of the kingdom unless it was well orchestrated. In other words, he would have handlers that would only show him the best of what was out there. And he never saw the struggles of the world. At the age of 29, he snuck away. He had his handler, his attendant named Chanda. And they went into the village for the first time. The Buddha saw on the side of the road, he saw a man laying there dead, and he didn't understand it. He says, "Why is that guy sleeping on the side of the road? Why doesn't he go home?" And Chanda said, he's not sleeping, he's dead. And the Buddha, Siddhartha at the time, had no frame of reference because he had never faced that. And he just could not understand that. And it struck him, I should say that it started developing in his mind, that if we're all going to end up like that guy on the side of the road, what's the point of anything? including this lavish lifestyle that he was leading. He continues to walk into the town, and he notices sick people and an old man creaking around, you know, and hunched over. He says, "What is that? What happened to him?" He says, "Well, that's just aging." He said, "It happens to everyone if you're lucky enough to live that long." And young Siddhartha's head is just twirling around. He can't come to grips with any of this. He went into town, and he noticed the competitiveness and the aggressiveness of the townspeople, just trying to eke out a living, just trying to survive. And all of this stress and suffering so impressed Siddhartha that he decided on the spot to leave that home that he had, and he talks about this often, leaving home and going into homelessness, to seek understanding, which was rather common during the Buddhist time. Young men around his age would normally leave the world behind and start wandering around northern India, southern Nepal, listening to different teachers and hoping to gain their own enlightenment, with the understanding that the enlightenment that they would give, that they would gain, they would bring back to their community. So it was well respected. The reason why I say that is there's people still today that criticize Siddhartha for leaving a home, leaving a wife and a young boy. His young son was just born a few months earlier, and traveling around northern India like it was a vacation. But it was very well accepted. And if it didn't happen, we wouldn't have what we have today, the Dhamma. So the Buddha wandered around northern India for 6 years, studying with all the great teachers of his time. In particular, he studied with two great meditation masters, at least great according to their own point of view, Alarakalama and Udeka Ramaputta. And the Buddha very quickly mastered their meditation methods and rejected them as not leading to his goal. Now remember that the what formed the Buddha and what got him seeking out to seek understanding and what he was seeking. He was seeking an understanding of the nature of suffering and if there was any possible way to overcome that. And so he wasn't concerned about mystical states of mind, which these other two teachers taught. He wasn't concerned about, and these two teachers were teaching dharmas. I use that to separate other teachings and what the Buddha taught, Dhamma, were based on the Vedas and later the Upanishads, which would become the modern day foundational texts in Hinduism. And again, there's a significance there that I'll touch on it later if I remember to. So the Buddha rejected these teachings because all that they were doing was distracting his mind, even though he describes developing rather pleasant mind states during these meditation practices, that they were just a distraction from what he was seeking. They didn't lead to the goal. He classified even these practices as ultimately painful and ignoble. So he left them, even though both teachers begged young Siddhartha to stay with them, and he would be their main representative, and again, great riches would follow. So he left, and he continued wandering around northern India. He ran into a group of fellow seekers, and they were practicing very severe forms of asceticism, with the thinking that if you denied the body to extreme levels, eventually it would somehow free the mind. That always sounded pretty silly to me, and I think it might sound a little silly to you. But that was a very well-accepted practice during his time, and it continues to this day. There's still a lot of very severe ascetic practices that are considered Buddhist practice, and it's something the Buddha rejected out of hand after mastering it. It is said that the Buddha mastered these ascetic practices to such a point that he could slow his breath to the point that you thought he was dead. He was living on one bean or one grain of rice a day. Again, this is another one of those ascetic practices. He recounts later on in his life that he was so emaciated that he could touch his backbone through his belly, touching his front. After many years of this severe practices, the Buddha's walking down the road one day and he passes out from malnutrition and he rolls down a hill and into the edge of a stream. And a young girl, Sujata, pulled him out of the river and nursed him back to health by giving him some gruel, some milk and rice mixed together. And he slowly regained his strength. Now understand what the Buddha has experienced in his life so far. He's had the extreme experience of having anything he could ever want constantly at his feet, and the far other extreme of denying every possible human need. And neither one of them brought him to his goal of understanding the nature of suffering. And out of that frustration, after he got a little bit of his health back, he decided that he's going to sit in meditation until he understood, until he gained an understanding of what he was looking for. And he remembered that meditation method that he had did practiced when he was 5 years old. And so he sat under a tree, the Bodhi tree. Bodhi means awaken. And there's the remnants of those trees are still there in northern India, in Bodh Gaya. The tree is still there. Immediately outside of the tree is one of the most commercial places on planet Earth. Millions of shops of trying to make money off of pilgrims that think that they go there, somehow that's going to help to enlighten. And that's just another commentary on what we've done to the Buddha's teachings. It really is one of the most commercial spots on the planet. So anyway, the Buddha sits down under this tree with this strong determination to simply be mindful of his breath and to calm his mind, and through that calm mind to gain insight into the nature of suffering. And so that's just what he did. And the stories have him sitting there anywhere from one night to 40 nights, some have it a little bit longer than that. The length of time is not important. And people will often take that length of time, well, you got to sit in meditation constantly for 40 days or 50 days to be, and that's not what the Buddha did. The Buddha was meditating off and on for 40 days. There's no account that that's all that he did. I mean, it was pretty intense meditation. And during that meditation, everything that arose in his mind, he recognized it as a reaction to the world rooted in a lack of understanding. This wasn't completely formed yet. And the legends often have the malevolent god Mara coming after the Buddha in his meditation and throwing these great armies at the Buddha to try and get him to stop meditating. Mara's so afraid that this young man is going to awaken and end Mara's reign. Much like the devil, isn't it? And much like the evil that's included in many other religions. So that's just metaphor for what was occurring during the Buddha's mind. And so Mara sent these armies. He sent these elephants after the Buddha while he's sitting there to try to get him to get off his cushion. Finally, Mara sent his seven beautiful daughters to tempt the Buddha off his cushion. And the Buddha just sat there in meditation, much like that. These things coming up in his mind. And every time he recognized that he was distracted by what was occurring in his own confused mind, he came back to the sensation of breathing. That was the formation of Samatha Vipassana meditation, and that's the only method that the Buddha ever taught. He would become distracted by his thoughts, he would come back to the sensation of breathing. And as he refined his thinking, he came to realize that it was his thoughts themselves that were causing him the confusion and ongoing deluded thinking that resulted in his own contributions to suffering in his own life. And upon fully developing that, and the Nagara Sutta is the sutta where the Buddha describes his awakening that I won't get into tonight, but on finally realizing that, his mind cleared. Looks like the audio went out again. And he awakened. And so what he realized then was that it was ignorance of the way things truly are in the world that resulted in all his confusion, deluded thinking, and ongoing contributions to his own suffering. And that's known as dependent origination, another wildly misapplied and misunderstood teaching. Excuse me. Dependent origination simply states, from ignorance of Four Noble Truths through 12 observable causative links, all manner of confusion, deluded thinking, and ongoing suffering, dukkha, occurs. Dukkha is the Pali word that describes, in a very broad and overarching way, the entire nature of disappointment, unsatisfactory experiences, all the way to outright physical and mental suffering. Dukkha is the word that's used. So his very first teaching then was something called the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta. The sutta that set in the wheel of truth in motion is what that means. And it's the only wheel of truth the Buddha ever taught. He taught four noble truths for the first time in human history. He makes that declaration. And everything he would teach for the next 45 years of his teaching career was taught in the context of four noble truths and in the context of dependent origination to gain an understanding of the true nature of life, four noble truths. The declarative statement that he made, the first noble truth, is that dukkha occurs. To most people, that is just too simplistic to even be worth thinking about. But what the Buddha is declaring there is that simply as a consequence of having a human life, there will be stress, there will be disappointment, there will be unsatisfactory experiences, there will be suffering. He's immediately pointing to the need to depersonalize this because it's not happening to us, it's simply happening. And we're having a human life in the midst of this. That also points to the insight that the Buddha teaches, very specific insight into the three marks of existence, the impermanence of all things, a misunderstanding of self, often the word is, the Pali word is anatta, the not self characteristic, and the suffering that results from misunderstanding the environment that we're in and the self we've created rooted in wrong views. So the first declarative statement the Buddha made is dukkha occurs, which is, if he elaborated on it, and he does elaborate on it, it's there's going to be pain and suffering in the world. He defined dukkha as birth is suffering, meaning simply being born in the world is prone to suffering. Sickness is suffering, aging is suffering, death is suffering. Relates directly to what he first saw when he left home, isn't it? There's nothing mystical about this, is there? Because there's nothing mystical about what the Buddha's teaching. It's entirely practical. It relates directly to our human lives, not some mystical life, not some magical way of thinking. How do we recognize and abandon our own contributions to that suffering? And then he would continue describing dukkha as not getting what is desired, what you want, is suffering. I mean, we all know that, don't we? And getting what is undesired, what we don't want to experience, is suffering. And we all know that. And then he would always conclude that explanation of dukkha as saying, in short, the five clinging aggregates are suffering. The five clinging aggregates simply describe the ongoing personal experience of suffering rooted in ignorance of four noble truths. The five aggregates are form, physical form, the feelings that we have within that form, the perceptions that are formed from those feelings, and the fabrications or the thought constructs, the hardened views that we create. And the fifth aggregate is consciousness. But it's not some grand cosmic consciousness. It's simply ongoing thinking rooted in ignorance of four noble truths. So because of that type of thinking, the experiences that we have through our physical body, interpreted by a mind that cannot see clearly, that's rooted in ignorance of the way things are, and it misinterprets things and takes things personal, creates suffering. So the second declarative statement that the Buddha ever gave was that craving originates and clinging perpetuates suffering. And that relates directly to wrong views or misunderstanding of the nature of self, doesn't it? It directly relates to our individual cause of suffering. And so now you can start seeing the three marks of existence and the four noble truths. Because of the environment that we live in, always impermanent, suffering occurs, dukkha occurs. Because of a misunderstanding of what constitutes itself, the second mark of existence, anatta, we contribute and continue suffering for ourselves. The third declarative statement the Buddha ever gave is that it's possible to recognize ignorance and abandon it. Cessation of suffering is possible, meaning our individual contributions to suffering. And the fourth declarative statement that he ever gave was that the Eightfold Path is the path to the cessation of our individual contributions to suffering. In other words, it's the path to go from ignorance or wrong view to wisdom or right view. And this Eightfold Path is the only path the Buddha ever taught. And when and over the years, as that path has been adapted, accommodated, embellished, or outright dismissed, the entire Buddha's teaching is lost because the entire context is lost. And we end up with all these different mythologies about the Buddha's birth and all these other things that, that have nothing to do with what the Buddha taught. And I should say at this point that I studied in all the major modern Buddhist schools. I took my vows in the Tibetan lineage. I spent many, many years in a Zen lineage with one of the foremost modern Zen masters since deceased. I won't name any names because it's not fair. And I found them all leading me to more confusion and more frustration. And it wasn't until I stopped looking at what was presented at Buddhism and looked at what an awakened human being actually taught, which is still preserved in the Sutta Pitaka, the second book of the Pali Canon, that it changed everything, and I was able to gain insight that allows me to teach what I'm teaching today, what an awakened human being actually taught. So this Eightfold Path must also be seen in context. Why would we develop the Eightfold Path? Because it relates to the three marks of existence, to the impermanence of all things and gaining an understanding of that, and going from a wrong view of self to a right view of self, and from doing that, ending our own contributions to confusion, deluded thinking, and ongoing unsatisfactory experiences. So the first factor of the Eightfold Path points us in the direction, in the right direction, away from wrong view and towards right view. The first factor of the Eightfold Path is right view. The second factor is right intention, and right intention directly relates to the second noble truth of craving originates and clinging perpetuates suffering. So right intention then is the intention within the framework of the Eightfold Path to recognize and abandon craving and clinging. Makes sense, doesn't it? A perfect response to the declaration of the nature of suffering and the cause of suffering. The Dhamma, what he would teach, requires the intention that we actually move our minds, move our minds in the direction that will allow us to recognize and abandon the cause of our own suffering, craving and clinging. The next three factors are known as the virtuous or the ethical factors of the Eightfold Path: right speech, right action, and right livelihood. And this is really where what the Buddha taught starts getting conflated with religion, because all religions, well, I shouldn't say all, there's a few that don't, but most religions teach morals and ethics as their foundation. The problem with most other religions is they don't recognize and abandon that it's wrong views that keep us acting in ways that are immoral and unethical. So right speech, right action, and right livelihood are factors of the Eightfold Path that we use to recognize when we're engaged in acting out of wrong views or views ignorant of Four Noble Truths. And for most people, it is becoming mindful of their speech. This is the essence of mindfulness, of what we're saying to ourselves and to the world around us, that we're able to recognize wrong views, views that are prone to creating suffering, stress, and disappointment in ourselves and others. Whether it's to argument or lying or self-aggrandizing or simply engaging in idle conversation that distracts me and the other person or the people I'm around. And I won't get into the specifics of right speech, right action, right livelihood, but essentially at their most base but most profound level, they all say remain harmless in thought, word, and deed towards ourselves and others. Right action is it follows in the same way, and right livelihood follows in the same way. The sixth factor of the Eightfold Path is right effort. And when the Buddha describes all of these factors in the framework of mindfulness, he teaches that we should be mindful of each factor. In other words, when we're in wrong view, to be mindful that we're in wrong view, to recognize it, and enter and remain or develop right view. When we find that our intention is not grounded in the intention to recognize and abandon craving and clinging, but is the intention in the moment is to promote continued craving and clinging, to recognize that, to be mindful of it, and to enter and remain into mindfulness of right intention. The same thing with the moral and ethical factors. To simply recognize when I'm engaged in wrong speech, wrong action, or wrong livelihood, that's the essence of mindfulness, isn't it? Mindfulness means to recollect or to hold in mind. To recollect or to hold in mind these principles that guide us towards awakening, integrating the Eightfold Path. The sixth factor of right effort, the Buddha would often describe right effort as the factor of the Eightfold Path that runs circles around all of the other factors, and to be mindful of the Eightfold Path. That is, that, and then he would conclude by saying, this is one's right effort. Now, how do we do it? It, for me, I had an incredibly strong desire that I'm so fortunate that I had, and you're here, you must have it, to develop the Buddha's understanding. But it took me a long time just to remember what each factor of the Eightfold Path is. And there's nothing, at least that I'm aware of, that's cognitively wrong with me. I can remember things. But even these simple eight things were difficult for me to just remember what they are. So it took initial study. I had to keep coming back to just what are they? What are they called? Not really what they mean. Until I could start integrating that. But that was the beginning of my Dhamma practice. And Frank talks about this often. He comes on Tuesdays and sometimes on Thursdays. That in the beginning of his meditation practice, and Kevin also, who usually comes on Thursdays, they would simply rehearse what they are, what the Four Noble Truths are in the Eightfold Path. Right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort. The seventh factor is right mindfulness. Now this is a significant part of the Eightfold Path because it implies very strongly that there's wrong mindfulness, isn't there? If there's, and sometimes you could use often, the better word is occasionally the right aspects of the path are called appropriate view, appropriate attention, skillful view, etc., rather than right. But it really gets to the point, but calling it right mindfulness and implies that there's such a thing as wrong mindfulness. So mindfulness means to recollect or to hold in mind. We can do that with anything. And the compulsive thinking that results from wrong views, that continues those self-referential views that create constant stress in our lives, takes ongoing mindfulness, but mindfulness rooted in ignorance. So it's a type of mindfulness that's holding in mind wrong views that can only continue wrong views. That's the sole reason for an Eightfold Path, so we can recognize wrong views, abandon them, and develop right view as the Buddha describes it. And again, the Buddha describes right view as a view that has completely integrated the Eightfold Path, understands the nature of suffering, and has abandoned within its own mind any individual contributions to suffering. Is that clear? And the reason why that's so important is that there's the modern mindfulness practice, modern mindfulness has mostly brought a fairly great measure of reduction in the stress and suffering in the world. And Jon Kabat-Zinn's work with mindfulness-based stress reduction is the best example of that. And by the way, Jon Kabat-Zinn is very clear that he's not teaching what the Buddha taught as mindfulness. He's teaching an adaptation of it that happens to be very useful. And the reason why I say that is that we have quite a few students come from mindfulness-based stress reduction here and continue to use that, but it's a separate practice and a separate aspect of our application of mindfulness than what the Buddha taught. The Buddha taught to use mindfulness to integrate and hold in mind the Eightfold Path. This is one, he would say, this is one's right mindfulness. The eighth, is your hand up or are you just?
Yeah.
Please.
Could you explain the difference between right view and right mindfulness?
Oh, it's a great question. Thank you, Nash.
Right
view would be an overarching quality of mind. Let me say it this way. Right view is a fully defined, refined mindfulness that holds in mind the entire Eightfold Path and looks at itself or refers to itself and the world around us from that point of view. There's no ignorance left in that right view. Now the Buddha would describe and does describe right view, awakened right view, fully mature right view, as a view that completely comprehends the nature of suffering. So in that way you can see that it is the refined mindfulness that's developed through the Eightfold Path that supports this ultimate type of mindfulness, constantly holding in mind that right view. And now the Buddha would describe the quality of an awakened mind again, in completely unambiguous, non-mystical terms, as calm, or at peace, or the another word it's often used is a mind resting in equanimity. It's simply balanced. Why is it balanced? Because that mind has fully developed an understanding of the nature of the first noble truth, dukkha, which means a profound understanding of the nature of dukkha means you have a profound and penetrating understanding of human life. You understand who and what you are in relation to the world around you. Another way of saying that is you have gained complete and total insight into the three marks of existence. The reason why I keep coming back to that is that there's this insight movement that's been around for 50 or 60 years, and there's other applications of insight that do not point and do not use the Eightfold Path to develop a very specific insight into these three marks of existence. And now we see how they relate directly to the Four Noble Truths. So it's a great question. The eighth factor of the Eightfold Path is right meditation. Again, the only meditation method the Buddha ever taught was Shamatha Vipassana meditation, what we just did tonight. Shamatha means to quiet the mind. Vipassana means to gain insight. So it's from a quiet, well-concentrated mind that develops the refined mindfulness that brings insight, vipassana, true vipassana, into the three marks of existence and leads to the development of profound right view and understanding of suffering. The simple act of Shamatha Vipassana meditation, of recognizing that we're caught up in our thoughts again, that we're distracted by our own thinking, that we're craving for and clinging to our thoughts and where we hope our thoughts will develop for us. And by the way, those thoughts are always objectified. They're always towards the past or influenced from the past into the future. They're never about what's occurring right now, unless or until we connect with our breath. And when we connect with our breath, our mind's calm, even if it's just for that moment, and we interrupt, again, it might be just for that moment, the ongoing process of compulsive thinking rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. I'm caught up in my thoughts, come back to the sensation of breathing. And for most of us, especially beginning meditators, that will only last for a moment or two. We might only be able to hold one or two breaths in mind. And we find that we're caught up in our thinking. That's wonderful. Come back to the sensation of breathing. The reason why I say that's wonderful is because if you're recognizing that you're caught up in your thinking, in fact, there's some meditation methods that say when you find that you're thinking, you just tell yourself, thinking, 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 what good does it do? It's just reinforcing your thinking, isn't it? And it's not really that the problem is thinking. We're conscious, we're sensitive and conscious beings. That's why I say that. We should be thinking. But for most of us, especially in meditation, thinking in that way should be much like our heart. We don't have to keep thinking about our heart beating to keep it beating. We're conscious and sensitive beings. We have a brain. It's constantly processing information. But when we're clinging to and craving for continued self-referential existence, it's actually our thoughts that we become so enamored with and continue the distraction. And it's that distraction that keeps us rooted in ignorance. So that simple method of right concentration, right meditation, of recognizing when we're stuck in our thoughts again and come back to the sensation of breathing. Every time we do that, we're deepening our concentration. And so the meditation method is not mindfulness of the breath, which is how it's often taught, and especially in modern breath mindfulness meditation. The importance of recognizing that you're caught up in your thoughts is almost taught as a negative, that you're doing something wrong, when in fact, it's the essence of meditation. To recognize that you're caught up in your thoughts, come back to your sensation of breathing. That's recognizing at its most profound level, that's recognizing and abandoning ongoing thinking that's rooted in ignorance of the Four Noble Truths. It's directly what the Buddha teaches in meditation. And so I'll just go a little bit further. And this is a lot to cover in an introductory class. The Buddha taught, in the Buddha's description of meditation, he would often just say, go find the root of a tree or an empty hut. Go find some seclusion. Go find a quiet place. And then he would say, and develop jhana. Jhana is another widely misunderstood teaching. Jhana is J-H-A-N-A. And it simply means deepening levels of meditative, jhana means meditative absorption. The Buddha teaches that there's four levels, or four increasingly deepening levels of concentration. There's nothing magical or mystical or unattainable about any of these levels. In fact, most every one of us that meditates in the proper method experiences at least the first three levels. And I won't get into them. There's articles on the website. But there really are just ever deepening levels of concentration, resulting ultimately in a mind. The fourth jhana is that mind resting in equanimity. And as it relates to meditation practice, that fourth jhana does not describe the quality of an awakened human being, meaning a mind resting always in equanimity. It's simply describing what occurs during meditation practice. And I would bet there was three or four people online a moment ago. I don't think they can hear me. We've all experienced that, even if it was just briefly. It's just that feeling of profound calm is that fourth jhana. And so as we deepen our practice, we deepen those levels of meditative absorption. We're deepening our concentration. And from that foundation of ever deepening concentration, we support the refined mindfulness necessary to integrate, to hold in mind, the entire Eightfold Path. Now, the last thing I'll talk about tonight is the Buddha taught how to meditate initially in the Satipatthana Sutta. Again, wildly misunderstood and misapplied teaching. It's the beginning part of the Satipatthana Sutta that are instructions for meditation. And the rest of the sutta, the Buddha gets into different concepts and applications and the Four Noble Truths and the Seven Factors of Awakening and the hindrances, etc., etc. Those are how to apply the concentration that you've developed in the beginning of the Satipatthana Sutta. So in that sutta, and this relates directly to the instructions that I give, the Buddha first says to be mindful of the breath and the body. That's what we do to begin our meditation, isn't it? And then he says to be mindful of feelings arising and passing away and thoughts arising and passing away, the second and third foundations of mindfulness. But within the proper context of the Buddha's Dhamma, we understand that it's not to get analytical about our feelings arising and passing away, or to get distracted further by them, or to think more about them, think. And the same thing with thoughts, to simply recognize that as a conscious human being, being mindful of the breath, feelings will arise and pass away, and thoughts will arise and pass away. Rather than being distracted or reacting to them, come back to the sensation of breathing. The first foundation of mindfulness is the initial guidance for what occurs during meditation. And then that fourth foundation of mindfulness is the instruction I give right before we come out of meditation. Notice the quality of your mind. The fourth foundation of mindfulness is ultimately to have a completely dispassionate, impersonal awareness of the present quality of our mind. And so I often say that we gain the ability to be at peace with less than peaceful mind states. Excuse me. So as that relates to the context of the Buddha's teachings and the Satipatthana Sutta, if we react to feelings that are arising, it distracts our meditation practice and concentration doesn't increase. And if we react to feeling, and it's not, the order is not all that significant. Sometimes it seems like thoughts arise and they create feelings. Sometimes the feelings arise and it feeds thoughts. It really doesn't matter. The point is that if we're able to be dispassionately aware of feelings arising and passing away, it will not affect that fourth quality of mind. Our minds will remain at peace. But it's important to recognize in the four foundations of mindfulness that if our mind is, the quality of our mind is agitated in any way, it's because we've reacted to a feeling arising or a thought arising or a combination of the two. A thought attached to a feeling or a judgment attached to a feeling is an emotion. So we've become emotional about what's occurring with us rather than developing calm. And why is that important as the fourth foundation of mindfulness? Because simply to recognize that, wait a minute, the quality of my mind is agitated. What should I do? Go back to the first foundation of mindfulness. So I think that's enough for an introduction to meditation and mindfulness, just to remember that everything the Buddha taught was taught in that context of what he awakened to, dependent origination, and the Four Noble Truths, and to develop use shamatha or vipassana meditation to deepen concentration to support that refined mindfulness. So that's tonight's talk. I hope you found it beneficial, but do you have any questions? Well, there's only two of us, so I'll ask Isabel first. Do you have any questions or comments? Did you find tonight's talk, please be honest, did you find tonight's talk helpful in, and I'll just put it, just reinvigorating or refocusing your Dhamma practice?
Yeah, completely. I guess I was just like, certain things were, I guess, like, I don't know if I'm going to use the word, like, triggering, but it's just like bringing up, like, where, just like instances where, like, if I was developing like my practice, how it would be helpful. I don't know. And
yeah, that's the way to see it.
Yeah.
How to apply
it. And just realizing like I'm still in the stage of mindfulness of like wrong view or wrong intention. Like that's like kind of where I'm at, and not that I'm not practicing right view, or not that I'm not trying to do that, but realizing how it's so easy to like be mindless and like get distracted and
And that's part of Dhamma practice, Isabel. That's the beginning of, and I'm going to say it's the beginning. It's a well-developed understanding of the proper application of mindfulness. To know when you're outside of that framework of the Eightfold Path. That's how we integrate it. So good for you. Glad you're here. Nash, good to see you tonight.
Good to see you too. It was nice to have a kind of like a refresher, because I kind of had forgotten some of the like foundations. Not forgotten, but I guess I had forgotten the 12 causative links. I had forgotten about those and their place in the Dhamma. So it was nice to have a reintroduction to everything, you know, from the start as we're, you know, gonna recontinue our practice. Just an observation I've had over the past couple weeks, I find that it's way easier for me to acknowledge and realize, even at the point of contact, like sadness and self-caused stress, than it is for me to, I mean, I'm not able to recognize my anger as being in a wrong frame, in a state of suffering at all. Like I almost like, and I notice mostly when I'm driving. I try to be a very patient I do think I am a patient person. But for some reason when I drive, I'm very short and I almost can't stop myself. It's not that I can't stop myself, it's just I react so fast that I don't, I'm working on it. You know, the first step is like realizing and at least being able to look back and seeing that I was definitely adding some suffering to myself and to other people. But that's just a little observation I've had, that it's personally, it's easier for me, almost like when the feeling is low, it's easier for me to recognize and to, you know, not let it, you know, to move on and like go faster. But anger is just, and I don't get angry very often at all, but I do notice that, and I have had anger problems before, and not like serious diagnosed things, but I've always had a temper. So I think it's, I'm happy that I've recognized it, at least.
Yeah. Thank you, Nish. That's fairly common. In fact, I often say I was born angry. When my mom gave birth, I slapped a doctor because it was too cold and the lights were too bright. Which maybe I did. But in my anger, often came out, and I never in my life ever hurt anybody. I didn't ever plot it to hurt anybody. Let me put it that way. But I've caused a lot of harm for people out of my reaction and my anger, and a lot of it came out on the road. You know, I was just for many, many years. I drove with my head and my hand out the window, you know, screaming and hollering at people. And my ex-wife, she used to always. I mean, she was terrified, not because I was a bad driver, but what I might get into because of the way I was. And then she would always be surprised. How could you be so angry at someone and the next minute you're fine? Well, I guess I had that ability, but it left me, forget what I was doing to other people. I was, I was definitely contributing to the pain and suffering of other people. But what I was doing to myself and when people were around me in the car. And I always felt justified, because that person was driving in a certain way that was unacceptable to me. And it took me a long, long time. Even once I started developing, that was probably one of the last things that I came to grips with, ultimately, was how foolish it is to think that I need to control other drivers in any way.
The most recent time that it happened for me, I don't really need to go into the specifics of it, but I yelled at someone. My windows were up, so I wasn't necessarily yelling to tell them something. I was just yelling out of frustration, and I realized almost the moment that after I yelled, I was like, "Oh, that wasn't good.
Yeah.
That wasn't okay." And then it was interesting. I went from that to being almost upset at myself for being upset, and then finally being able to let it go. It was an interesting little chain reaction.
Yeah, and your mind calmed. That's a perfect and practical application of what you've developed. Now when I see other people acting the way that I used to act, it fills me with understanding and sadness for that suffering. Because I understand it so well, because that's where that's where I came from, and nothing was going to ever change that in me. All the, I shouldn't say, because I don't know it. Making a declarative statement that no matter what type of therapy, maybe it would have, but I don't think so. But when I came to the Dhamma, it worked exactly as the Buddha said it would work. I developed a calm and peaceful mind. That's not to say I still occasionally get upset, but it takes. Trying to think of what I don't know. the Dhamma works in that practical way. It develops a calm and peaceful mind. Why? Because think about when, just using that as an example, getting upset at other drivers is taking something personal, isn't it? It's probably the best example of taking things personal. The Dhamma teaches us that there's nothing to take personal because we are always in a constant process of becoming. Do I want to continue to become awakened? Well, then I'll protect my mind and I won't fly off the handle. You mentioned restraint. I don't know if you noticed, and I might have mentioned it last week, there's another category on the drop-down menu called the Wisdom of Restraint, and it has 6 or 7 articles and talks recently on that. You might want to just start looking at that because they directly relate to how to develop restraint at the sixth sense base, where we're coming in contact from our views to the outside world. And that, again, that's the essence of what the Buddha taught. And as you're reinvigorating your practice, be gentle with yourself.
I'm pretty good at that.
Good.
I'm just, eager is not the right word, but very reassured in the Dhamma, and that, something that's always stood out to me is you said something like, this will take 7 days 7 weeks, 7 months, or 7 days, if as long as you keep doing this and you, you know, live your life in the framework of the Eightfold Path, you will become awakened.
Yeah.
And so that's, you know, that was the first, like, big aha moment for me in this, and, you know, was just, this will, you know, you will do this. This is very obtainable and meant to be obtainable. It's not exclusive in any way. It's meant to be as inclusive as possible.
Yes. That the Buddha makes that statement often in two of the famous suttas of the Satipatthana and the Anapanasati Sutta, that, you know, the awakening, gaining full human maturity, is assured. The timing doesn't matter. As long as you continue to integrate and live within the framework of the Eightfold Path, you will. You'll develop a profound understanding of the nature of suffering, and your mind will rest in peace and equanimity, no matter what's occurring. What more could we want? What more could we want? And it's in this human life that we awaken. Pretty good deal. All right, we'll finish with metta, as we always do. Unless you have any questions or comments? Good? Okay. So again, find your relaxed meditation posture. And gently close your eyes and gently close your mouth. And again, become mindful of the sensation of breathing in your body, your in-breath and your out-breath. And these are the Buddha's words from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing, in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short, or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you for a wonderful class tonight. Peace.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. I welcome your questions and comments. To contact me and for guided meditations and instructions, Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos, please visit becoming-buddha.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Peace.